Lynn's going to talk about faith on the frontier, religion and community in early Orangeburg.
Thank you, Dan. See if we can wake this up. Eric, if you can do that. A lot of what is on the PowerPoint are actually my cue cards, basically, to myself. So, what I'm going to talk about today is the period from the founding of Orangeburg up until basically around the period 1800. And what I'm going to say is going to be pretty different from some of what you heard last night from Father Larry. And so I'd like to explain that going in. Father Larry gave us basically the understanding of what happened that Alexander Sally had and wrote in his History of Orangeburg. Well, from the time that Alexander Sally wrote his book, up until the German-Swiss Society was founded, there was very little research on the German-Swiss. And so there was very little progress. And so, basically, when I talk about things that are going to be different from what he said last night, it's because of all the research the German-Swiss Society has done over the years that we now have a much better understanding of our early ancestors and their faith. And Jim Rickenbacker's work in the original Swiss archives and so forth has just been magnificent in the microfilm copies, of course, but that has helped a lot. And so this will be different. What Father Larry said was the accepted version for a very long time. But what I'm saying is right. Okay. Western Frontier. When the townships were legally created, this was the western frontier of British settlement here. There was nobody here but trappers and Indian traders. And when the town of Orangeburg was founded, the only resident was John Hearn, who was listed as a hat maker from James Island. And you said, what does a hat maker do up here way away from any town? And, of course, what he was actually doing was trading for furs and hides for the Indians, which was his family business. His uncle had been doing this. He had been trading with the Indians and, unfortunately, had also been trading Indians and slaves in an area he was between Utah and Holly Hill. And so one of the first settlements in the backcountry was John Hearn the First, setting himself up there and then being killed and scalped in 1715 at the end of the Yemassee War because the Indians were fairly tired of being enslaved. His nephew then set up shop here in the Orangeburg area, and there were a few other families. If you look at the early land records, which Brent Holcomb has so brilliantly made easily available for us all, there was a group of people who petitioned, all with English names, when the townships were created to have their areas where they settled made into grants in spite of the townships, and this was done. But these were these first traders. They really didn't much care whether they had a minister around, and they didn't. And the church didn't care whether they had a minister around. And so when the townships were established, that brought family life and communities to an area that had not had those things. The original settlers between 1735 and 1737 in Orangeburg were Swiss. And some of them had been living in Germany for a while. We'll talk later about why that was so. But they were still originally Swiss. The Schulers, for example, you look at that, they're in the parish records in Baltimore, Germany. But they were from Fehrenbaum in Bern Canton, Switzerland. It was a period of great disruption in Europe. Poverty, war had created so much problem. And of course, Switzerland, very limited land. If you were a farmer, as time went by, families ran out of adequate farmland. The Church of England was the established church in the colony from 1706 on, and it was very closely allied with the government. And then there was the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, also known as the SPG. And they were responsible for ministering to the whole of the colony, but they really didn't. They, at one point, London, the Bishop of London, as Father Larson said last night, Bishop of London oversaw this area. There was no local bishop. Was supposed to send a missionary into the Indians and so forth, but he found that the food, wine, and company were better in Goose Creek, and he pretty much stayed there. Now here we have a map of where the townships were, the ones of more immediate interest to us. We have up here Orangeburg, yes, Swiss. Amelia was very heavily settled by people coming down from Virginia, people of English or Scots Irish descent. Saxgotha up there, again we're getting references to the English crown's connections with Germany in this. Saxgotha was founded by Swiss and a small contingent, 280 actual German citizens. Over here we have New Savannah and then New Windsor. New Windsor was another Swiss settlement, but the first to actually get settlers was Perrysburg down here. And Perrysburg was a mixture of German Swiss and French Swiss. And right across from Perrysburg was Ebenezer, which was Salzburger German Lutheran settlement. But Perrysburg, Orangeburg, New Windsor were essentially all Swiss, and Saxgotha was the combination. Languages. Switzerland, of course, is very mountainous. What's it known for? Dialects could be very differentiated. So, and there was had to have been some use of what's called High German, or what could be more standard. We also had French Swiss. There were a fair number of French Swiss, including Perry, at Perrysburg. And there was a scattering of Italian-speaking families. Of course, the Jennings family of Orangeburg actually began as the Zaninis. Here we have the Swiss homeland, and the Orangeburg settlers came from a fairly restricted number of places. Bern Canton, lots from Bern, a few then from up on the Rhine, Basel, Zurich, Athens, Innerrhoden, and St. Gallen. Nobody from Athens, Innerrhoden, and there's a very good explanation for that. Athens, Innerrhoden was all Roman Catholic. And the English were not taking Catholic settlers if they didn't help them. Most of these settlers had very little education. There were exceptions. Johann von Zeeland, I'll talk about more later, he actually settled eventually in Windsor and then went on to Savannah, was from Appenzell Ausserhoden, and was probably the most distinguished Calvinist theologian in the British colonies. And which makes it even more interesting that people thought these guys were Lutheran. Okay, so major religious groups in 18th century Europe, Roman Catholic, some of the Swiss cantons we don't have settlers from because they were Roman Catholic. Fribourg, for instance, is right next to Bern. But we have, in fact, Fehrenbaum, the Schuller hometown, there actually is a jog in the boundary between Bern and Fribourg to make sure that the Protestant German Swiss in Bern were on the right side and not in the Roman Catholic Fribourg. Lutheran, most common denomination in Germany, but fairly rare in Switzerland. Reform. This is not the same as the Reformation. The Reformation is a large development of churches arising separately from the Roman Catholic. Reform is very specific and different. And the Swiss church was basically reformed. And when we have gotten into the original records of the births and marriages of our ancestors and the burials of their ancestors, And a lot of the work Jim Rickenbacker and others have done in the parish records from Switzerland, they're in the Reformed parishes. That's where they're coming from. Anabaptists, Lutheran Baptists, and then there's the Anglican Church of England and its offshoots, which eventually included Episcopal and Methodist. Okay, the Swiss Church was founded by Zwingli, who lived at the same time as Martin Luther. He rejected transubstantiation. The Lutheran Church to this day is, like the Episcopal Church, very liturgical and theologically not Calvinist. The Reformed, Zwingli, and then later Calvin, this is the Reformed Church. Historically, the French Huguenots and Belgian Walloons were Calvinists, and the Presbyterians. And it's interesting, for instance, we think of the Huguenots who came to South Carolina. Actually, very small number of Huguenots came to South Carolina. After they began persecuting Huguenots in France, the population in Bern became about 20% French Huguenot. And they were going there because this was a theologically compatible place. It was the same religious background that the Huguenots had in the Swiss Reformed Church. Okay, church and politics in Switzerland. Politics in Switzerland are fascinating. It is not a top-down country. You become a citizen because you're a citizen of a community, and that community is part of a canton. And it's the confederation of the cantons that makes Switzerland. So this is one of the reasons. This has been altered somewhat in the past 100 years or so, but historically, you had to basically inherit the right to be a voting member of a village, and in fact even own land. So that's very handy for us in tracing our ancestors, because they couldn't move around a lot. You know, if you could vote in Fehrenbaum and you had a right to land use in Fehrenbaum, you didn't leave Fehrenbaum. The New Windsor settlement over on the Savannah was led by Johann Tolson. And he had been Landeshauptmann, which is similar to governor of Appenzell Ausserrhoden. And he left because he was opposed to the use of churches to raise troops for mercenary armies. So there was very often a connection between church and state here in Switzerland. It varied by canton, how strong it was. Unfortunately, Switzerland has a long history of mercenary soldiers. And this is especially true in eastern Switzerland. One of the neater things that's happened is once I figured out that our supposed hazelwoods here in Orangeburg were actually isopus from Appenzell Ausserrhoden, and we put that up on the website, we got an email from a family historian of the isopus family whose father had written them up, and he had traced their family, the whole isopus, back into the 1400s. And he sent me the records on our lines, and it's generation after generation dying in the war in Macedonia, dying in the war wherever. Anyway, this was a lot of people came here because of poverty, but some came because they actually had problems with the way church and state interacted in Switzerland. In Germany, southwest Germany, along the Rhine, which gave us a lot of our later Orangeburg German immigrants. There was Roman Catholicism in some areas, but there were villages that were Reformed and villages that were Lutheran. Whole books have been written about the history of political and sometimes armed conflict, given that arose out of this. However, when we look at things like Schuller's living in Baltimore for many years, what's going on there is they too were going to a place that was the same faith as their own Reformed tradition. But if they went 20 miles away, it might be Lutheran. And here we have sort of the relevant section of Germany. This is the Swiss Confederation, the Rhine River, and Lauten, like George and I, has had fun of sailing through part of the Danube and the Rhine, cruise ship, but Heidelberg, all this area, Edmonton, our Edmonders, my Edmonder ancestors, their name basically translates to from Edmonton. Edmonton, all this area, the Neckar River, the Rhine, this later gave rise to German immigrants. Okay, denominations in South Carolina in 1750, Church of England, mostly on the coast. They were not sending ministers inland. Presbyterians, we had up on the Waxhaws, which would be Lancaster, York County now, the PB and around Beaufort, there was a Scottish settlement, had a lot of Presbyterians, very scattered, didn't have their own ministers for the most part. Huguenots, most of the Huguenots were assimilated into one of the other churches by 1750, mostly Church of England. Reformed, that's the Swiss, Swiss settlements. Lutherans at Saxe-Gotha, there was combined Lutheran-Reformed congregation there. There were about 280 Lutheran, German Lutheran settlers at Saxe-Gotha. They are the legitimately Lutheran pre-1750 settlers in that country. Society of Friends, little known fact that many of the original settlers of Charleston were in fact Quaker. Mm-hmm. Many of my own ancestors were Quaker who settled in Charleston in 1670, or a few of them. Most of the Quakers fell away through the years, but that was a big, originally there was a meeting, a Quaker meeting in Charleston long before there was a Church of England. And various unaffiliated Congregationalist and Baptist groups. You had things like the Dorchester, Massachusetts folks coming down. Okay, Orangeburg. Sally wrote that the Orangeburg settlers were Lutheran. He tried to divide them between Swiss and German based on his own notion of which names were German and which names were Swiss. He thought the Schulers were German, which is not true as it turns out. And again, every time we traced one of our Swiss families to the Swiss parish records, they were in the Reformed Church. The first Orangeburg minister was an incredible character. All the existing banner was a silver goldsmith of Toggenburg, which is now part of Appenzell-Ausserrhoden. And it's not northwest Switzerland, that's northeast Switzerland. Sorry about that. And he had immigrated, actually, with the Perrysburg group. But they had a falling out. The Perrysburg group decided they really didn't want him with them, and he didn't want to be there. And he and a few others broke off. He ended up in Charleston. And he was never ordained in any denomination. He fought ordination in the Swiss Reformed Church and the Reformed Church in southwestern Germany. One of the things that's happened over the years since Sally did his work is that we acquired historians who can actually read German. Sally could not, a lot of the early South Carolina historians could not, so they couldn't do anything with German records. Well, we now know that this endeavor tried to be ordained. Why was he not ordained? He was really pretty unorthodox by the standards of standard Reformed Church. He was a pietist, a follower of a movement that combined Lutheranism and reform and an emphasis on personal piety. So he became a teacher, and he was a very controversial teacher. He was kicked out of one place after another in Switzerland. There is evidence that he believed in direct illumination in dreams, basically personal revelation, and instruction by angels. And this was consistent with a lot of the pietist things, ideas going around. And he was affiliated to some extent with what were called inspirationalists, which were a branch of the pietists, who believed the Holy Spirit gave them direct revelations. And physical contortions and vocal outbursts would accompany these revelations. And so his personal faith, although there was no historical connection, I want to emphasize that, it's not a historical connection, but it had something in common with modern Pentecostalism. You know, the sense of the Holy Spirit coming over you and you respond in time. Some of the Orangeburg settlers may have shared his perspective, but we don't know. We know they were Reformed. There's some evidence the Swiss government was kind of initially happy to see him leave because they suspected them of being, you know, their faith being a little unorthodox.
And churches do like to keep their doctrine straight. However, this was not just unique to Gessendammer. It wasn't unique to Switzerland. Even Henry Lawrence, who was, you know, of Huguenot ancestry and was one of the Revolutionary War era leaders of South Carolina, has been described as his faith as a mixture of Calvinism and Pietism with a touch of revivalism. And, you know, that really sounds a lot like Lord Gessendammer. And he was banned from St. Gallen for a while. He was banned in Zurich. He went on to Germany, where he was banned again by the local Pietists. He was accused of taking God's honor for himself. Well, this was all very hard on him. He returned to Switzerland and lived a very quiet life for 10 years. He then a traveling Pietist minister came through and wrote later that he felt that Gessendammer had been slandered a great deal over the years, that he was not, he shouldn't have been treated so unfairly. But, you know, it's quite possible that the whole experience in 10 years mellowed him a great deal, too. He resumed preaching, but again, the local church authorities weren't very happy about that. So, people were going to Perrysburg, and he decided he'd go along because he really wasn't welcome to Switzerland or Germany. He settled in Charleston to pursue his career as a silver and goldsmith. But in 1737, the Swiss asked him to come minister to them, and he did. I mean, he was recognized as a teacher in Switzerland, even though he wasn't ordained. He had a lot of background in theology, and so the Swiss cared a lot more than these scattered traders ever had about having a regular church presence and a regular religious life. And so they invited him to come up, and he agreed. He only lived about a year after he began his ministry here, but he did bring his nephew, John Gessendammer. And the congregation asked John Gessendammer to take over from his uncle. And what's really amazing is that we discovered he was 18 years old when that happened.
Whoa! Wow.
And John Gessendammer wanted to be ordained, and he must have been pretty well trained himself in theology, because as Sally reports, and everybody else has noted, he went to Christian Mott, who was sort of a translator and government liaison for the Swiss settlers, and Mott told him that the appropriate thing to do was to go to the Presbyterian elders in Charleston for ordination. Now, that's treated by Alexander Sally as a mistake, because, of course, Sally believed that these people were Lutheran. Well, it wasn't a mistake. Mott was from a family that had been Huguenot, and he knew the Calvinist when he saw one. And so he sent him to the appropriate people, the Presbyterians, for ordination. And they examined him for his theology. I mean, they didn't just say, sure, you want to be a minister, you can be a minister. You know, they put him through a theological and biblical examination, and at the age of 18, he satisfied their criteria and became their minister. At a very young age. Frontier morality became a problem. It turns out he was serious about being a minister. And he would get up in the pulpit, apparently, and suggest that it was maybe not the best thing in the world for people to be drunk on Sunday, or playing around with other people's wives, or other interesting things. And so there were some people in the congregation who thought that was really kind of, you know, he was going too far. He was asking a little too much. Again, we're talking about a frontier settlement. And for those of you who've worked with the parish records that the Gessendammers kept, they baptized children noting, in some cases, you know, that so-and-so came with her child to be baptized, and the father came with her, and it was not her husband, it was somebody else. So he didn't take it out on the infants, you know, the fact that a child might be illegitimate, he'd go ahead and baptize them, but apparently he would speak to the parents about it. Some people took exception. At the same time, we have Zimmerbuehler Jr., whose father had been a minister at Perrysburg, and he was very ambitious, and he was going to be ordained in the Church of England. And he thought it would be really nice if he had the parish in Orangeburg instead of Kissendam. And he started petitioning the council to get rid of this, you know, uneducated and not ordained in the Church of England minister and install him instead. And he actually got Alexander Garden Sr., who was at the time in charge of basically the Bishop of London's representative in Charleston, to agree with him and to give him letters to the council saying he approved of this happening, which was interesting in itself because how the Church of England thought it was within their authority to replace a minister who was ordained by the Presbyterians is a little vague too. But the people of Orangeburg, above fourscore of the Dutch and English inhabitants of Orangeburg, led by John Harn, the original settler who was the hat maker for James Island, sent an indignant protest to the governor, praising this manner and declaring that Zimmerbuehler was, this is why we know the history of this, was being encouraged by residents who retired being reprimanded for, quote, great irregularities and disorders, along with Sabbath. In addition, in his defense, John Gissendamer was described as a man of learning, piety, and knowledge of the Holy Scriptures, very articulate and intelligible. I should explain this was written by one of the people from Amelia, who was a native English speaker, and always behaves himself with sobriety, honesty, and justice, encouraging virtue and reproving vice. We know the problem we had is that reproving vice part. They really didn't want that in some cases. It's nice to know that more than fourscore of our ancestors were in favor of not having vice. The original record, as far as I can tell, has been lost. But we have to assume that, you know, this was probably the majority of the heads of household. There were probably a small number of people who were trying to encourage the reveal. Anyway, the issue was that they eventually canceled plans to move Zimmerbuehler in, and Reverend Gissendamer remained in Orangeburg, continuing to preach against the disruptive and ungodly with the approval of many of his congregation. This was not, of course, a problem unique to Orangeburg. Johann Tobler, the founder of New Windsor, wrote that there is a serious problem with drunkenness and disorderly behavior among some of the settlers at New Windsor. In 1749, Orangeburg settlers petitioned the council, because again we have the government and the church hand in hand, to allow John Gissendamer to go to England and be ordained, study there for a while, and be ordained in the Church of England by the Bishop of London. And they're very frank in their petition when they ask this. They say they were under the expectation of enjoying the same privileges and immunities in society which their fellow subjects do enjoy, had at all time willingly and cheerfully contributed their assistance toward the support and preservation of the government. Now, Governor Glynn, in his letter supporting this, says, the Red Calvinist, again, How did these people have to identify as Lutherans? Governor Glenn said the Red Calvinist is going to England for orders. So, in short, what the Orangeburg settlers are saying is, we have contributed our support, we paid our taxes. Those taxes are what paid the stipends to the ministers. You're not paying our minister now. We want you to pay our minister, and we want the other rights of full citizenship that come with being a member of the Church of England. So we really don't see a major theological conversion here. what we have is a conversion of expediency. This was not the first time this happened. In 1706, the Church of England became the established church in South Carolina. At that time, the Huguenots had mostly, some came in 1680, most came in after the 1685 disruption in France.
And they maintained Huguenot congregations for a while. We all know the French church survived in Charleston. There was also a parish on the lower St. Key. St. Denis, which had to have been named by one of the English, thinking they were giving them a French saint because it was actually the patron saint of the Roman Catholic royalty in France. But anyway, the Huguenots, after the Church of England became established, most of the Huguenots converted very quickly and became Church of England. A few became Presbyterians. The Legree family, for instance, was notoriously resistant to being incorporated into the Church of England. And eventually, John Sibley became minister to a large group of these ex-Huguenot types. Although the Gissendana congregation did not continue a formal Reformed tradition church, there is a Reformed church in the U.S. still today. And the nearest example I could find listed at their website is First Reformed Church of Cary in North Carolina. However, Marble Collegiate Protestant Dutch Reformed Church in New York City, which was Reverend Norman Denson Peale's church, was a Reformed church. And it's the oldest denomination in North America with a continuing ministry. That church, Marble Collegiate, was founded in 1628 and it's never had an interruption in its ministry. Reverend Zumlin is of particular interest because he was one of the Perrysburg settlers. He was the son-in-law of Orangeburg settler Ulrich Tobler, cousin of the Foster family of Orangeburg. For those of you who are Duke's descendants, this would be the family of Joseph Duke's third wife, the Frosters. So he had a lot of Orangeburg connections. There are reports that he sometimes preached in Orangeburg, which is very likely because he traveled a lot. He would have visited family in the area. Ulrich Tobler was dead, but he did have surviving family like the Forsters. And he was apparently just a really phenomenal person. He was, as I said earlier, one of the foremost Calvinist theologians. He was known to preach in the same day in English, German, and Latin.
Wow.
Depending on his audience. I mean, if it was talking to fellow theologians, he'd slip into Latin. And he became a member of the Second Constitutional Convention. He ended up in trouble with both the Patriots and the Tories because he kept writing, and in fact giving sermons, saying that the settlers should not reject the crown, they should reject the English Parliament and have their own Parliament, but still owe allegiance to the crown. And so he paid a heavy price, as people often do, for being ahead of his time. He was basically proposing the British Commonwealth, just had to be a few centuries too early. And he brought a lot of, his house was burned, his library was burned, people, you know, went through a lot of trouble with that. Everybody was fighting with it. But he had Orangeburg connections, he founded one of the first Presbyterian churches there. Okay. In about 1760, John Gissendana's health deteriorated. We start seeing, you know, there's no more entries in the journal. He died in 1761. The Church of England had still really assumed no responsibility for Orangeburg, and they did not make any effort to replace it. Samuel Souter was here. He'd been here during some of Gissendana's ministry, and in fact was baptismal sponsor for one of my ancestors. And he was a Swiss Reformed minister. And he preached for a few years, just a couple of years, before going into North Carolina, where he was one of the founders of the Presbyterian Church there. This again speaks to, you know, it was again a Calvinist who took over as soon as John Gissendana and so on. Now, at that time, before the Revolution, the Church of England had one itinerant minister up in the Waxhaws. And I really recommend anybody who wants to read early South Carolina history, read Charles Wood Mason's journal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Caroline on the Eve of the Revolution. It is a fabulous book. He took his own fork because he did not want to share with his families in his congregation that had one fork for the family when they were eating.
One.
And he generally had a very rough life up there in the Waxhaws. Okay, there were eventually German Lutherans, the Ebinger family, for instance. Were in fact Ebingers, and they were German Lutherans. But we don't see them arriving until around 1750 and later. And so most densely was in Lexington County, although some put down roots in Lorraine and Orangeburg and Calhoun counties. The mother church of the Lutherans in South Carolina was St. John's in Charleston, founded in 1755. Okay, you know, 20 years after the Reformed Church was established in Orangeburg, basically a whole generation, established by Reverend George Friedrich. A lot of Orangeburg surnames appear in St. John's Register, including Cannons, Myers, and Pendarvis, who were in fact English but had married Kettle with the Swiss, Sandal, Seifert, Alts, Bonnaker, Dice, Young, Neighbor, Zimmerman. People who go to Charleston have relatives in Charleston affiliated with St. John's. Sometimes you see mixed congregations because the importance of the language outweighed the theology. You know, if you were a German speaker, you might go to St. John's in Charleston just because you knew you could understand the service. Saxe-Gotha was all along a mixed one. Ebenezer, Paul's government required conversion to the Lutheran denomination before he would minister to anybody who'd been Roman Catholic. The point in his study of religious conditions among the German-speaking congregations in South Carolina observed that if we were to judge the German Swiss and Germans by certain contemporary statements, the picture is not a very pretty one. Pastor Bolshus of Ebenezer was never reluctant to express his opinion on things, and he denounced the people of Saxe-Gotha as filthy, spiritually wretched, splitting and contending Reformed Lutheran factions. He said that many migrated from other colonies where they had been unsuccessful, basically said they were driven out. He indicated that some of them were unwilling to work, and some were horse, and I think we have here a typo, but horse and cattle thieves. So much for the people of Lexington County, South Carolina. They had really interesting things going on theologically. They did have a Reformed minister, Christian Fayette. However, they also had the Weberite heresy, in which Weber, this fellow, declared himself to be God the Father. Schmidt Peter, who was another settler, was designated as God the Son. And a, quote, godless colored preacher was designated as the Holy Spirit. Unfortunately, this trinity was not happy together. In spite of their fun and games, they were practicing, quote, extreme wonkiness. They were rebuked by Pastor Christian Fayas. And in return, they tried to drown Pastor Fayas in the Conwy River. He escaped with the help of a boatman. They quarreled among themselves, and they suffocated the Holy Spirit. Then they returned on Schmidt Peter, God's son, and announced him as Satan. And they beat him and trampled him to death. And they also killed another bystander, Michael Hans.
Wait a minute. Who did that to those? To the Holy Spirit?
The Wet Rocks? No, the person who said he was God's father.
Oh, he took him
with some friends. One of the Geiger family was involved in this, by the way. There are several others who were with Faber who were also tried for murder. But word of the Weberite sect had spread as far as Maryland by the time they got out of each other. And this wasn't unique. You know, you get these backcountry settlements and all sorts of things that go on. But Reverend Charles Wood Mason, the same fellow who took his own fork, described some of those who interrupted his services in the Waxhaws as, quote, the worst vermin on earth.
Basically, the colonial governments were tolerant of a wide range of irregularities in frontier settlements. They just weren't intervening a lot. Okay, the media and Orange were going to even a revolution. I'm afraid that, again, we have to have a correction from last night. When Samuel Souter left, just a couple of years after the death of John Kissinger, both Orangeburg and Amelia were left without ordained clergy. We know that John Kissinger was ministering to Amelia as well as Orangeburg, but often hold services in family homes in Amelia and the Russells and Maxwell and so forth. And so in 1767, a traveler named Griffiths found in Orangeburg only a tavern, a store, and a man who pretended to preach.
Wasn't that one of the problems Mason was talking about with the lack of a preacher? People were living together without marriage because there wasn't any way to get married.
That's right. He had to go to Charleston to get a second
one. Yeah, so he called them off out of things.
Yeah, in 1764, the House of Commons was petitioned by a group from Amelia to make provision for a minister in Amelia, which is the King St. Matthews. In 1765, the Orangeburgers also asked that their township be made a parish. The House did that. They responded by creating a parish consisting of two townships in areas below Amelia. But it was vetoed by the Crown because it would have entailed adding two members to the House of Commons. Okay, we had church and state intervening again. In 1768, St. Matthew's was made a parish with only one seat in the House, and that seat was taken from St. James Goose Creek. Provision, they were also told they could make provision for a chapel. However, they did not put that chapel in Orangeburg. They put it at what is now Santee. If you know where Chapel Branch is and the country club, right, on the north side of Santee. There's an African-American church there. Their parking lot is the site of the old chapel for St. Matthew's. The Reverend Turklin ministered in Amelia, not Orangeburg, as we were told last night, which had become St. Matthew's until the Revolution, and he maintained the only continuing presence of the Church of England in the area. There is no record whatsoever of his ever ministering to Orangeburg. I mean, the families there are the St. Matthew's families. So Orangeburg was completely orphaned, and no parish was established here. So, for all practical purposes, we will see how an educated and ordained clergy leading active churches from the Revolution until the Great Awakening. And you know, we're left then, too, with a gap in our genealogical records as a consequence. Eventually, we start seeing brush armor churches and camp meeting locations established in the late 1700s and early 1800s, which many of which eventually grew into established Methodist and Baptist congregations. White House Methodist, of course, the earliest Methodist. George Whitefield, the Methodist evangelist, came through. And I have read many times his really rude comments about the person who's ministering in this area. And I tried to find it for this talk, and I couldn't. But then he also made rude comments about the Bishop of London, theology, so we don't know. He was pretty picky.
What was his last name?
Whitefield.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, because he went on to Savannah.
Right. Yeah. The Constitution, he was involved with Zubley in the Orphan Council. Okay, the Constitution of 1778 finally permitted incorporation of non-Church of England congregations. In 1788, the England German-speaking congregations banded together as the ecclesiastical union of several German Protestant congregations dispersed abroad in the back parts of the state of South Carolina. And they petitioned to establish 15 congregations. And there are very few remnants of the Swiss Reformed tradition at this point. Christian Theus at Saxe Gotha was Reformed, and the rest are Lutheran, basically, if they had another ordained minister who was mentioned. Frederician Church on Kettles Creek, I think that was actually founded by the Frederick family.
That's one assumption, but I've no evidence.
Right.
But
Peter Frederick was a member. Right. German Calvinistic Church of St. John on Thorold,
Okay, here again, we have a remnant of the Swiss tradition. We get up into these churches in the Lexington County area, Tomah Creek, 18 Mile Creek, so forth. It's very heavily Lutheran, and we have Protestant Church of St. George's on Indian Field Swamp. My guess is that was sort of early, who knows. It wouldn't have been Lutheran because they seem to have said so when it was Lutheran. And there were five additional German-speaking churches in Canada in 96 districts, but most of them concentrated in Orangeburg, Lexington, Calhoun counties. From both those churches, St. Matthew's Lutheran survived and is still in place. If you read their historical plaque, they claim descent from the Gifts of God Our Church, with which they actually have no association. Again, it's the confusion about whether it gets a banner of Lutheran or not, I'm sure, which led to their thinking that. White House is the only surviving Methodist church. Calvinism officially reappeared, although Methodism has some elements of that in it, but Calvinism reappeared with the creation of the Presbyterian Church in 1735. The Church of the Redeemer was established by the Episcopal Church as an offshoot of St. Matthew's, basically, in 1551, and the first official Baptist congregation was 1860. Yes?
Presbyterian, you mean 1835?
1835, right. Typos. Glad
well,
you caught that.
May I point out one other thing? The White House Church was 1788.
1788, okay.
Right, and that petition was also 1788 with all the 15 churches.
Mm-hmm.
The, down at Kettle Creek Methodist Church, they claim the same period.
Mm.
So that Frederican Church at Home Kettle Creek was 1788. But the Bishop Asbury came through this area spreading the Methodist. Starting Methodist society.
Mm-hmm.
And so my assumption is that the Frederican Church on Kettle Creek became Kettle Creek Methodist.
Kettle Creek Methodist, right.
Now that's just an assumption.
But it's a fair assumption given it's certainly the same families.
It's also interesting that 20 years after that, that whole area from White House Church on down Indian Field and so forth was 100% Methodist.
Mm-hmm.
It was in there with them. The Daniel Seifert deed the property for the White House Methodist Church at Auto 301 in 1790, and they have a stump of a tree that Bishop Asbury used to preach when he came to the and was still in the sanctuary.
Wonderful. I didn't know about the tree. We have, when I was growing up, you know, certainly in the rural areas of Orangeburg County, the only question was whether you were Methodist or Baptist. There's now a Lutheran church in Vance. You know, it just has to be people who moved in along the lake or something, because otherwise unheard of.
I'm interested in the last line about I can't see a lot of it, but the 1860.
Mm-hmm.
What location are you saying? Is in the county or in the district?
It's in the county, but I've forgotten exactly which.
It's in town, I think, because there were Baptist churches out in Fort Hood as early as 1805.
Oh, okay.
So that I think that occurs in Orangeburg.
In Orangeburg town.
Yeah.
There were certainly Baptist congregations.
Yeah.
You know, what you call an official church in that early 1800 period, you know, very often they were brush harbors, so there was as much a congregation as any other. And so, you know, it's kind of artificial to say when they finally built a building that was permanent, it became a church.
Just one aside, when Francis Asbury was doing the circus, what we call it, he had with him Richard Allen. It was this black servant, African American, or whatever, but he was a better preacher than Asbury, I understand. And he would have all the slaves and African Americans in the backyard. He'd be preaching, and everybody would be lives in Asbury in the house. So you're probably right. Everybody in that area was Methodist. Mm-hmm. He was slipped.
Well, and, you know, there. Early 1800s, unfortunately, very few of the records survive from these churches. If they had an ordained minister, very often the records disappeared at some point. We weren't as lucky for these places as we have been for the Gissendammer Church. But it's a very important part of our heritage. And, you know, when we look back through it, we see that, you know, basically Orangeburg involved, by the time all was said and done, a giant mix of theological approaches. Growing out of a Reformed background, followed by Lutherans, and then a fairly artificial Church of England presence. we doubt very much John Gissendammer's preaching changed. When
he did start speaking in English.
He did, though. Well, they were very pleased in the media that he was articulate and intelligible in English. And they found him very sound theologically. And I'm not sure how great a judges of theology of Russell's, Maxwell's, and so forth were, but anyway. So, other questions?
Okay. Then, of course, there weren't Moravians in South Carolina, but the original Moravian settlement was in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to Pennsylvania, and Pastor Eckbein came back. See if he could recover his land in Georgia. He kept a journal, and when he went to South Carolina, he said a few things about the Perrysburg settlement. Not too kind. And as he crosses over into Georgia, Savannah River, Pastor Bozius speaks to him there. First thing out of his mouth is, this new Lutheran, are you Lutheran? Yahweh, he needs his property. Yes, he's United Brethren. Okay.
Highly critical one. Everyone who wasn't Lutheran, and some who were.
Well, you know, when you put it out on the map, that Rhine Valley area, the Strasburg area, there were so many different religious beliefs in that system that it's understandable why some people had to leave, because they couldn't agree.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started in the 1500s with printed a Bible, and then everybody could read and started, you know, decide later on the Holy Spirit or whatever.
Right, although that had some interesting offshoots. Yeah, I think one reason the Reformed Church didn't survive is it was so early. It was too early for the larger other Reformed congregations to help keep it going. But a friend of mine from Cologne, Germany, this fellow anthropologist was doing work in northern Mexico with the Mennonites there. And he got permission to work among them doing anthropology in return for teaching their children High German so they could read the Bible in German, which is really, when you think about it, very ironic, because the whole reason, I mean, one of their core beliefs was to have it in your own language, which was German originally, but they never made the transition to the fact that their children were speaking Spanish. And they didn't know any High German, and so the people cling to their traditions. So, any other questions? Pam, you want to?